Today, the story of how a mother was reunited with her children 4 years after they were kidnapped by their father and taken to live in ISIS-held Syria. And, in opinion, The Guardian's Gary Young on Liam Neeson.
A few weeks before Christmas, I got an email from The Guardian's Middle East correspondent, and she sent me a picture of a woman and told me her surname, which was Ferreira, and asked me to find her because her two children were stranded in Syria in Rojh camp, and they'd been there for 18 months. They were 7 and 11 years old, and they were unaccompanied minors.
In 2014, thousands of people from across the world flocked to join Islamic State fighters as they seized huge swathes of land in Syria and Iraq. Some of them took their children. This is the extraordinary story of how one mother from Trinidad and Tobago managed to rescue her sons from war-torn Syria with the help of journalists, a human rights lawyer, and the rock star Roger Waters. It begins with two boys found in Rojh camp in Syria, clutching a photograph.
How have these kids kept this picture of their mum for 4 years while they've been in Raqqa, at the centre of the ISIS caliphate, when they'd lost everything else, all their worldly possessions, but they'd kept this crumpled picture somewhere on them? That was very moving.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a mother's journey to rescue her sons from ISIS. Josh Surtees is a journalist who writes for The Guardian and lives in Trinidad and Tobago. Last year, he received an email from our Middle East correspondent, Bethan McKernan. She'd been told about two children from the island who were stuck in a camp in Syria.
She sent me through an email with a brief report of these two kids from Trinidad, Ayub and Mahmoud Ferreira. It was all kind of vague, the details about who they were. They knew they were from Trinidad, they knew their names, and that was about it. But what they'd been carrying with them for 4 years, since they were taken from Trinidad by their father, was two pictures. One was their mum and one was their paternal grandmother. And Bethan asked me to identify the mother, to find her.
The copy of the crumpled image was all that Josh had to go on, because the boys had been so traumatised from their time in Syria, they'd forgotten their mother's name. So what did you do?
It was a stroke of good fortune, really, that my wife, who's Trinidadian, and her family are kind of quite well connected, and she just said, oh, I'll ask her sister. I showed her sister the picture, and she said, yeah, I know them. That kind of seemed a bit like fate. So she contacted a mutual friend who she knew would be able to get in contact with the mother, Felicia Perkins Ferreira. And eventually I got her number and I spoke to her. And then I met her about 2 weeks before Christmas in a shopping mall. And I asked her to go through the whole story again from scratch of what had happened to her.
Felicia remembered taking the boys to the beach in the summer of 2014. She described a happy time when she just celebrated her youngest child's third birthday. On the evening of the 20th of June, their father visited and said he wanted to take his sons to his mother's house, just for the night.
And he told the boys, tell your mum you love her, give her a hug. She told them she loved them. And the next day she didn't hear from him. And that's when her panic started setting in. And then I think the following day, somebody told her that they thought he'd gone off to Syria to join ISIS. That's when her nightmare began, really. It wasn't until at least 3 months later that the husband called her, and he never really told her exactly where they were. But subsequently, you know, we know that they must have been in Raqqa.
In the years that followed, Felicia's life fell apart amid depression, panic, and worry. Her former partner allowed sporadic contact, but if she ever raised questions about the safety of her children, he warned that she would never speak to them again. She didn't know where they were or how to get to them, and she says the authorities were unable to help.
The last time she heard from the father of the children was when he called her as Raqqa was being liberated in October 2017.
Forces in Syria are celebrating the defeat of ISIS in Raqqa. The city was a major stronghold and the terror group's self-proclaimed Syrian capital.
We walked into the heart of Raqqa today, once the pride of the so-called Islamic State. Now reclaimed after a four-month battle by these US-backed fighters.
He apologised to her, she said, for what he'd done and told her that he was sending the kids to safety.
Felicia felt completely helpless.
The thing that was really hard, and the first time she started crying while I was talking to her, was when she told me, you just don't know how hard it is to carry on with your life, your work, when you're completely empty inside because your children aren't there. You know, she was becoming more and more traumatized, depressed. She started having panic attacks. In fact, she told me the day she realized where they'd gone was the first day she had a panic attack. And ever since then, she's kind of had them on regular, if not daily basis.
In Trinidad, Felicia didn't know that someone was trying to find her to help secure the release of her sons. Clive Stafford Smith, the prominent human rights lawyer and founder of the charity Reprieve, had heard about their case while representing a woman who had recently been in Camp Rog. She said that while she was there, she had taken two young brothers, who'd been found living in desperation in the toilets, into her care. When she left the camp, she took their photograph with her. Clive, you've been involved in this story for several months now. Do you know what happened to the boy's father?
We're not sure what happened to the father. I have heard information that he's recently been detained by the SDF, the Syrian Defence Force, but I haven't confirmed that. We thought that he was dead up till then. What happened to the boys was rather more dramatic. They're driving along with this people smuggler, and they begin to come to these checkpoints, and the smuggler says, oh, you know, you've got to pass the Syrians now, and can't have any of those black kids. So they're put out on the side of the road, and so they're left there, and fortunately fell into the hands of the SDF and the Kurds, and they got them to Camp Raj.
Clive wanted to visit the boys, but to do so needed Felicia's permission.
When Josh said that he had the mother's contact, it was great because I could immediately get Josh to get her to sign an authorization so I could go see them, which I did. Then I go see them in the camp with the camp commander right there, a very nice woman. And I'm asking them various questions, and you know, they're children, for goodness sake. And actually, Ayub was much more voluble. He was young enough, I think, not to realize that this wasn't just the way life was. Mahmoud was really, really traumatized, and it was hard to get him to talk. So I asked them, you know, kids, what do you want for Christmas? Because I thought I might be able to just stop off and get them some presents. And little Ayub says to me, I want a hug from my mummy for Christmas. And then Mahmoud said the same thing. And I've got to say, it made me teary up. And so I said, I promised them then and there that I was going to get their mum there pretty quickly as soon as I could.
Is there anything? Oh, God, I've got three boys as well. So
it does me. I mean, it's pathetic. I just get all weepy at that point.
For the brothers to actually leave the camp, Felicia would need to be there in person. In Trinidad, Josh was trying to help organise her paperwork.
I thought I'd just be helping her and Reprieve with the travel documents that they needed to get, because the civil service in Trinidad operates quite slowly, and I knew, you know, I might be able to speed it up a bit. But on the day that I took her down to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Immigration Department, and we found some very sympathetic civil servants who managed to get these passports and emergency travel documents issued. She then, as soon as we knew that we'd got the passport sorted, she turned to me and she said, so you're coming with me then? And I laughed was my first response. And because it should be very clear, she's a very funny woman. Despite this absolute nightmare she's gone through, she's extremely stoic. And the first thing I said to her was, "You'll have to ask my wife." And we called Clive Stafford Smith at Reprieve, and we put him on loudspeaker, and we said, "We got the passports." And he said, "Wonderful, that's great."
A trip as ambitious as this was going to need money and influence. Clive Stafford Smith happened to be having lunch with a longtime supporter of his charity, Reprieve, who offered to help.
The first time I became aware that Roger Waters was involved in this was when Felicia sent me a WhatsApp message saying that a rock star was going to bring them back, comma, Pink. And I said, what? With, you know, three question marks. I said, the singer Pink is going to fly them home in a private jet. And she said, "No, wait, hang on, let me check. Roger Waters from Pink Floyd."
I love this.
And I just thought, this, how more surreal is this going to get? All in all, it's just a metal brick in the wall. I knew it was going to be a long, grueling trip. Felicia had never left Trinidad before. She was scared. We got on the plane. She'd thought that she'd have a fear of flying. Turns out she didn't even realise. 20 minutes, we're up in the air, and she turns to me and says, "Are we flying now?" We got to London. We were met by somebody from Reprieve. We then flew on to Zurich and landed there. And that's the first time we met Roger Waters in a restaurant of a hotel.
Can I just pause for a minute and just say, this is unbelievably surreal. I mean, how were you feeling?
I was feeling like it was all in a film, really. The whole thing felt like a film. Next morning from Zurich, we set off on a private jet and we land in Erbil, and there's a day of going to meet officials from the Iraqi Kurdish administration, shaking their hands, putting Roger Waters in a seat opposite them, him saying some really powerful stuff, and then Clive reminding them of the mission that we're on.
For you as a human rights lawyer and also for Reprieve, why is it that you get involved with celebrities? Does that make a big difference to the work you do?
It makes an enormous difference, and I'll give you an illustration. I went to Pakistan with Jemima Khan one time on drones victims, and she's incredibly famous there. And we did a press conference together, and I was quoted by 2.7% of all the media of Pakistan, and Jemima was quoted by 78%. And Roger gets that, and having Roger there has a huge impact. And, you know, that's great. It's really powerful for the people I'm trying to help.
That night, the team were given the go-ahead to enter Syria and bring back Ayub and Mahmoud.
So we set off before dawn. It's still dark. We speed it, going at high speed across northern Iraq. We crossed the Tigris River on a boat and are picked up on the other side. The whole region is Kurdish run, but there's one checkpoint with a Syrian regime soldier standing there with a big poster of Assad there. And then as we got to the building in Kashmili, you know, she's very quiet, very apprehensive, and we see how many press are waiting there. 40 reporters and camera people and camera crews, and me and the security guys just looked at each other and just were like, how are we going to negotiate this? We'd insisted that the reunification had to be done in private, and the security who were with us just ushered her through these cameras into a room that the boys had been in for several hours and just slammed the door on the media. It was extremely moving. I don't think I'll ever forget the look on Mahmoud's face, who's the 11-year-old boy, and the look in his eyes, and his face was wet with tears. She was crying. They were embracing each other. And then they let the cameras in, and the cameras were feet away from their faces, snapping away. And it was all a bit too much. And we, as quickly as we could, got them away from that and into the car.
The most touching moment for me of the entire escapade was when we had reunited Felicia with her children in Kamishli. And she had not slept for 3 nights. She hadn't eaten for 3 days. She had fainted in the hotel. She was really in a bad way. And then I turn around in the car we're in, and this makes me a bit teary, I'm afraid, but she's there with the two little kids on her lap and asleep. It was just lovely.
That moment was just so clear that this is what she'd been waiting for, so that she could feel at ease in her heart and in her mind and fall asleep. And it was a very beautiful thing to see. The flight home with the boys and Roger's private jet, you know, these two kids were in their new clothes. They were walking around. The main things they wanted to do were either watch Harry Potter on the TV or play games on their mum's phone. That's their main thing. Like every kid, really. They're quite normal in that sense, you know.
Yeah. Sounds like my kids.
And they also, with me and the one of the security guys, they played cards and they knew how to play Go Fish. And that was brilliant. We had an amazing game of cards with them.
What does all this mean to Felicia, do you think?
Oh, I'm not sure if it's even sunk in yet. It's going to take years, I think, to get back to just normality. She's telling me the boys are really already happy and glad to be back. And she's got a very good family network. And I hope they're just all going to be able to just make sure everything's going to be okay for the boys.
What will happen to the boys now?
Well, it's tough. These kids have been through an immensely traumatic experience. You know, Roger Waters, to his immense credit, is not going to just drop them off and forget about them. So he wants to help support them. And we have got them trauma counseling and so forth. So I hope that they'll work through this and get on with happy and productive lives.
And what about all the other children like Ayub and Mahmoud who are still in Syria?
There are 1,248 children in those camps. There are 584 women. All of those are the children of somebody, too. And the number of people who contact me at the moment to say they've got the loved ones in this god-awful place miles away from anywhere, I mean, it's just horrifying.
Why hadn't they already been rescued?
You know, there are several reasons for that. I'm afraid, I hate to say this, and I say this more in sadness than in anger, the British government is the biggest problem here. They have been leading a policy of leaving everyone in Syria for populist reasons. Everyone has been refusing to take their children back, except for Russia and the Sudan and Indonesia, but all the other countries are refusing. I'm glad that the French have broken the line in the sand on agreeing to bring people back. I hope to goodness we don't get more of the sort of nonsense from the security minister here in Britain, which is basically talking about criminalizing little children who come back from Syria and treating them as if they are somehow, you know, bomb-throwing maniacs, which is just not true. We need to take those children and help them and not further stigmatize them.
You can read Josh's story and see the photographs from the rescue at theguardian.com. Coming up, we'll hear from The Guardian's Gary Young after the actor Liam Neeson described in a recent interview taking to the streets with a cosh, which is a heavy stick, to find a black man to kill in revenge for his friend's rape. Welcome back. Now, Gary Young on why we are not living in a post-racial society.
So, Liam Neeson gave an interview to The Independent, and it was to promote his new film, Cold Pursuit. And in that interview, in order to kind of illustrate vengeance, which apparently is a key theme in the film, he talked about somebody close to him who was raped. And when he found out, he asked them, "Did you know the person?" was his first question. And his second question was, "What color are they?" And when she said that the person was black, he said that for the next week or week and a half, he would go out with a cosh, hoping that a black person would provoke him so that he could kill him. And he said that he felt ashamed that he had done that, and that kind of made him think, although it wasn't really clear what that made him think. My reaction to that in the first instance was how very odd. How odd to ask, "Well, what colour was the person who raped you?" That I've had friends who've suffered sexual assault. It's never occurred to me to ask them what the colour was of the person who assaulted them was. And you have to wonder, if the person had been white, would he have gone out with a cosh and wanted to beat up every white person that he saw, or kill every white person? Or would he have just killed himself? He's a white guy. My second, to be honest, was, well, that's not really a response that's open to me and others. And goodness gracious, aren't black people incredibly forbearing? If you think of George Zimmerman or any number of atrocities that have taken place in the last 5-10 years that we know about, then you would have black people running amok, killing all sorts of white people, and you don't have that. You suddenly understand perhaps why people like Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King, and this is Black History Month in America, are so revered, and because they didn't follow a revenge hypothesis. So I thought it was incredibly sinister that there should be collective punishment for the actions of one person. What you can only surmise is that for all the talk of a post-racial society and enlightenment values and the Obama era and so on, that there are some people, including the man who was nominated for an Oscar for playing Oscar Schindler, I mean, that could not have made a dent on him, that he would think, I'll go out and I will kill the first black person I see who gives me any trouble at all. So the journalist for The Independent says, but then again, which one of us hasn't been there? Let's put ourselves in his shoes, as though this is maybe a universal response. But it's not. I've been the subject of racial attacks. I've been beaten up by the cops. My family has been the subject of racial attacks. I've never gone out there, or I've never thought, actually, not just done, I've never thought, well, watch out, white people, here I come. Now, you could say that this is an expression of regret, and that's true, and that's important. He's not boasting about it, but there are a couple of things about that. And the first is that sets the bar very low for regret. I regret thinking for a week to 10 days that I might kill any black man that I saw. Well, I mean, if you can't get over that in a couple of minutes, then, there's got to be a helpline for you somewhere. And in fact, far from being an isolated concern, a kind of media flurry, the reason why I thought it was worthwhile writing about, because this is a lived reality. There are actually people out there who go out and try and kill black people because we are black people. In October, a man in Kentucky wandered around a parking lot and shot two elderly black people. And when a white person confronted him, he said, "Whites don't kill whites." At the weekend, a black security guard was shot dead by cops in the suburb of Chicago while doing their job. This is not some abstract a problem. This is not Benedict Cumberbatch saying coloured people when he meant black people and, you know, everybody getting excited about it. This is actually real life, or quite often real death, for people in lots of communities. And there don't have to be that many deaths for everybody to feel the fear. And another way of saying that is that Liam Neeson is not alone. There are lots of people who think like that, who act like that, who are emboldened by the politics of this moment. And some of them have a badge and an entire legal system to support them. And that's why I thought this one was worth taking up.
You can read Gary's column at theguardian.com. That's it for today. My thanks to Josh and Clive for sharing Felicia's story, and to Gary Young. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Lucy Greenwell. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Plus, we're now offering an additional 50% off our 3-month subscriptions, only when you subscribe before the 17th of February. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.